Good morning. My name is Yitzhak Etshalom, and I'm delighted to be continuing to study with you Megillat Eicha. Over the past 3 weeks, we have studied in each week one of the prakim, the first three prakim of Eicha. Last week, we saw the longer and modified version of Kinah Meter, Paragimel, which is 66 short psukim. And what we saw as a lead-in to Perek Daled, because Megillat Eicha, even though it is poetry, is sequential. And there is a development of a dialogue, really, between the Mekonen, who we understand to be Yirmiyahu, and the audience. And in Perek Gimel, we saw that the Yirmiyahu presented an autobiographical sketch, presenting not only his own troubles, which is the easiest way that we identified him as Yirmiyahu, because they match with what we read in the autobiographical sections of Sefer Yirmiyahu, but also because in the way that he uses that experience and his own life lessons to try to coax the people to respond in kind and to find a way really out of the paralytic and paralyzing trauma that they've experienced. As we will see, Perek Daled is the turnaround in their experience. Perek Daled is where he succeeds. And maybe that he succeeds simply by sheer force of numbers, shall we say, of more and more descriptions finally breaks through. And it could be that there's something in the way that he describes the trauma and the catastrophe of the destruction of Yerushalayim that gets through to them. But what we will see next week in our final shiur is that he is successful to the extent that we need. And so let's take a look at Perek Daled. As I mentioned, I have a surprise for you this week in that we're going to spend approximately 20 to 25 minutes maximum on the Perek. And then we're going to take a dip into a beautiful area of our destruction literature, if you will, which is the world of Agadah. We're going to look at a very famous Agadah, very famous rabbinic legend about the destruction of Yerushalayim that really emerges from the near the beginning of our Perek. Very well-known story, but it's a story that is almost always studied on Tisha B'Av, and as a result of that, suffers from the fogginess that we typically feel when we're studying on Tisha B'Av. And here we'll have a chance to look at it a little bit more rigorously and see some very surprising things. But let's do first things first. Let's take a look at the Perek. I would like to just take a moment, and I think it's particularly fitting because even though Torah in Motion is a Baruch Hashem international classroom, it's a classroom whose host room is in Canada. And I happen to be in Canada right now visiting. And this is a few weeks since the second yahrzeit of a very, very dear friend, Rabbi Reuven Bulka, who for over 50 years served as a rabbi in Ottawa and was seen by many as the chief rabbi of Canada. He was an amazing personality, and it was really a schut to be his student and to be his friend. So teaching in memory of Rav Reuven Pinchas ben Rav Chaim Yaakov, zichro libracha, and maybe the inspiration of his many, many good works and his inspiring leadership be something that moves us all to get more involved, to bridge more gaps between people, and to really bring Dvar Hashem into the world, Bidarkei Shalom, as he did so beautifully and so eloquently. I will tell you that in our home, we miss him every day. Instead of presenting the entire text of the Perek and then a breakdown, I wanted to go straight to what I believe is the proper understanding of the structure of the Perek. And again, as we've seen in each one of the previous prakim, the structure is elegant and is deliberate. And what you can see here is that there are 22 psukim, of course. It's an Abecedarian acrostic. Again, the pei comes before the ayin, as we've seen. And the first 10 psukim are one piece. The next 10 psukim are a different piece. And then the last two psukim are a coda of a very different stripe that we've seen so far. So the first 10 psukim really describe what was really the terror that animates Megillat Eicha, which is the siege and the famine and the people dying in the streets, especially the young children, which is a continued image that is evoked. Again, I can't stress this enough. In the first four prakim of Eicha, the Mikdash plays a minimal role in the mourning. The mourning is mainly about the siege and the famine that ensues. Eicha Yu'am Zahav Yishne HaKet Matov. And here the Mekonen takes a slightly different take, evoking the beginning of the first parak, which is to describe the former glory of Yerushalayim and what it's become. So how is it possible that the gold has become dimmed, that the beautiful, another word for gold, has become dulled? What are we talking about? Ishtapechna avnei kodesh b'rosh kol chutzot. All the holy stones have been thrown out into the streets. Now, this does not necessarily refer to the stones of the Mikdash, because that's indeed not even what had happened in the destruction, but rather, this is very likely talking about precious stones and of wealth, as you'll see. B'nei Tzion hayikarim amasulaim bapaz. The young men of Tzion, who were decked out in gold, echan nechshavu l'nivle cheres, they suddenly became like shards of pottery. So again, it's about the wealth and the glory of the people of Yerushalayim that now they are impoverished. And then we go back to the image of the child dying in its mother's arms, which we've seen notably in the second parak, but also in the others. Gam tanim machal tzushad heiniku gurehen. Even a jackal would give her breast to nurse her young. Bat ami le'achzar kaya'inim bamidbar. Evidently, the ya'ina, the ostrich, has a reputation for being ruthless towards its young. Of course, an ostrich doesn't really nurse. But nonetheless, my people have become ruthless. Now, the ruthlessness here is not because of meanness, but because I have nothing to give. Davak l'shon yonek el chiko bat sama. The baby, the nursing baby has had their tongue stick to its palate because they're so thirsty. Olalim shalu lechem poresen lahem. They're begging, little children, they're no longer nursing. Little children are begging for bread and nobody is cutting any bread for them. Nobody is giving any bread for them. They are starving. Parenthetically, this image of davak l'shon yonek, I had a great aunt who fled from her small town in Poland. She was a newlywed and she was newly pregnant from her husband, watched her husband from the bushes being murdered by the Nazis and ran away and hid in a pit in the forest and gave birth to her baby there and nursed her baby until she had nothing more to give and the baby died in her arms. She later joined the partisans. Long story there, but for me, when I read these psukim, these very much impact in a very real way. Ha'ochlim l'ma'adanim nashamu b'chutzot. Those people who would eat festive meals are now desolate out in the streets. Again, the streets being the image of poverty, because people who are wealthy are in their homes, they're in their palaces, they're having their meals. People are starving out in the streets. Hamunim alei tola chibku ashpatot. The people used to wear fine clothes are now holding on to and grabbing onto dung piles to find something. And unlike what we saw in the first and second prakim, and for the most part in the third parak, which was to avoid mention of the sin of the people, here it becomes prominent. And the notion is that my people sinned worse than stone. How's that? It's judged by the punishment. Because what do we know about stone? two things about the destruction of Sodom, as terrible as it was, that the Mekonein is highlighting as a measure of compassion. One is that its destruction was immediate, as opposed to a destruction that takes place over time with famine and starvation and a siege. And the second thing is that it was not done by any humans. Sodom was destroyed by God. Here, there are people coming in and are despoiling the city, etc. Zakun Zireha Mishelag, and again, going back to the young people, it's almost always the young people, the babies, obviously, and also the glory of the elders. But the young people, the vibrant, vital young people, and what's happened to them is a constant image. Zakun Nizireha Mishelag. Her young men, now Nizirim here likely doesn't mean Nizirim in the formal sense. It's very likely Nizirim similar to the Nizirim mentioned in Amos Perak Bet. And the idea there is young men who moved away from or swore off earthly delights to become more spiritual or more directed, and they were finer than snow, and it's whiter than snow, tzachu mechalav, whiter than milk, admu etzem mipinim sapir gizratam. They had beautiful figures, etc. What happened? Chashach mishfor ta'oram. Their image has become blacker than black. Lo nichru bachutzot. They couldn't even be recognized out again in the streets. Again, bachutzot continually through the parak as the place where all the tragedy is seen. Safan oram al atzmam yavesha yachaetz. Their skin is stuck to their bones. They are dry and brittle as wood. In other words, these young men who previously showed health and robustness now are like nothing. And then he concludes this section with, again, a comparison. The comparison here is not between the great that existed and the terror that exists now, but between different kinds of terror. And that our terror is the worst, similar to Pasuk Vav, where the destruction of Sodom is seen as at least a finer way to go than what we experience. Tovim hayu chal lecherev michal le'ra'av. Better to die by the sword than to die by hunger. Why? Shem yazuv medukarim mituvot sadai. At least they had freshets of blood coming from them when they had died. In other words, they were healthy, they were killed by the sword, and their blood was flowing healthily. A very strange way to look at it, as opposed to people who are just sitting there withering away. Yedei nashim rachmaniyot, and this brings us back to the birds at the beginning, or the animals at the beginning. Yedei nashim rachmaniyot bishlu yaldehen. Women who are otherwise compassionate women cook their own children. Now, this is an image that we find in Malachim Bet, Parakhet, in that story that the woman calls to the king, I made a deal with another woman. We'd eat my son one day, and then we'd eat her son the next day. This is the middle of the terrible famine and siege in Shomron. So these women are cooking their children. This is, of course, evokes the tochacha that we have in Sefer Devarim. Hayu levarot lamo b'shever batami. And there's something poignant and very powerful and painful here, which is these children became the havra'ah for these women, meaning these women are mourning, and the sudat havra'ah, the mourning meal, was their own children and the destruction of the nation. And that's this image that just is so powerful that, as we will see, it finally gets to the people. And now he moves to describing the city. Up till now, it was the people, the children, the famine, etc. And now, the destruction of the city. Kila Adonai et chamato shafach haronapo. God has used up all of his anger, spilled out all of his wrath. Now, there's a little bit of consolation buried in there, is that if his wrath has all been used up, then we're now moving in a good direction. But still, we're dealing with the destruction. He He lit a fire in Sion, which destroyed all of its foundations. And now we go back to the very beginning of Perek Aleph. None of the kings, none of the people who lived there could imagine that enemies could actually come into the gates of Yerushalayim. Because Yerushalayim, from his description, was seen as impregnable. Now that, by the way, is an idyllic kind of image. It's not accurate to what we read in Sefer Malachim of the last 100 years, shall we say, before the destruction. But that's the image that we're using now, is, and it's evoked also, if you take a look in Tehillim Ayin Tet, how could it be that these foreigners, people of nations that aren't even supposed to marry into the nation, and now they're coming into your Mikdash, but now the fact that they can even come into the city of Yerushalayim itself is unthinkable. Mechatot nevi'eha avonot kohanah, and we're going to come back to this in the second half. It is the sins of her nevi'im and the sins of her kohanim. In other words, where is the finger pointed? The finger point is not pointed at the people. It's pointed at the leadership. And keep that in mind. Hashofchim mekirba dam tzadikim. Now, were the elders actually spilling the blood of innocent people? Remember, tzaddik in Tanakh almost always means innocent. Is that what was happening? Or does it mean that because of their bad behavior, their terrible leadership, and the terrible abuse of their position, that that as a result of that, that's what happened, that the tzaddikim died? So, unclear. We're going to see more about that in the second half. Na'u ivrim b'chutzot. So blind people were wandering out again b'chutzot, again out in the streets. Now, are these people really blind? Are they blind because the destruction is just so overwhelming they can't see their way around? Are they blind spiritually? Unclear. Nigo'alu badam. They are filthy with blood. Below yuchlu yigubil v'sheyem. They are unable. They're touching their own clothes. They have to feel their way around. They can't touch anything else. Suru tame karulamo. Suru altigao kinatsu gam na'u. So they're saying to people, get away, you tame person. And those people don't want to touch each other out in the streets. This reminds us of what so many of us went through a couple of years ago. Stay far away. Leave me away. Amruva goyim lo yosifu lagur. And then they were told, you can no longer live among the nations either. We are nowhere. We're out in the streets. We're nowhere to go. In the house, there's nothing there. There's death. Out in the streets, there's death. We have nowhere else to go. It's God's face, meaning God's hashkacha, that has split them up, moved them away, and will not look at them anymore. Now here, the sin comes on the people, but notice the turn. Beforehand, he was pointing the fingers at the Kohanim, his finger at the Kohanim and the Nevi'im who sinned. And now he's saying it is they did not honor the Kohanim and the Zekanim. And as a result of that, God did not look at them. And we're going to see that also towards the end of the Shiur of the Midah Keneged Midah, of them not honoring the face of the Kohanim. And so therefore, God's face turns away from them. And then at the end of this section, it goes back to the geopolitical reality that I described in the introductory shiur of the role of Tzidkiyahu, the Babylonian puppet king, who was from the Davidic line, Yoshiyahu. For the first 8 years of his vassalage, if you will, he was loyal to Babel. And then took very bad advice and signed a treaty with Egypt. And of course, that treaty didn't do anything for us except to raise the ire of Babel and lead to the destruction. So, Odeinu tichlena einenu el ezratenu havel. We are still looking up, meaning all the people are still looking up to their empty help, meaning they were still looking for Egypt to come and help them. Bitzipiatenu tzipinu. El Goy Lo Yoshia. We were anticipating and looking forward, but to a nation that wasn't going to help. Sod Tza'adunu Milechat Bechovotenu. I want to point something out, just this point about the poetic style. is that this happens often in Abecedarian acrostics. I'll give you one quick example from Ashrei, which we all know, that often in a pasuk, towards the end of a pasuk, the letter of the next pasuk will be hinted to. So, for instance, Ritzon, the Resh in Ra'ashrei, Ritzon Re'av Yasev et Shav'atam Yishma V'yoshiem Shin 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 to Shomer, to the next pasuk. So the same thing here is in the Tzadi pasuk. So Tzadu Tzadenu Milechet B'chavotenu, our steps are now trapped, meaning walking even in our own streets, we're trapped. Karav kitzenu. Notice we're onto the kuf already. Malu yamenu kiva kitzenu. And the kuf and tzadi together, bringing the current pasuk tzadi and the next pasuk kuf together. But it is a deliberate style of the biblical poets when it comes to acrostics, especially sequential acrostics. So
the previous pasuk has it also. The ayin pasuk leads into the tzadi pasuk. Tzipi tanu tzipinu.
Yeah, you'll see, actually, if you look through, you'll see it in quite a few of the psukim. It's a pretty common thing. Not in all psukim, because some letters don't actually work very well at the end. Like the Zion psukim, I don't think have... let's take a look, actually, for a second. Yeah, actually, you have it here. Zakun ziram yishalag tzachu mechalav. Takes us to the chet, but not at the end of the pasuk. Tets are also hard, but many of the letters are quite common. So, karav kitzenu malu yamenu kiva kitzenu. And the word kates, of course, means the end. And our end is coming and coming nigh. Our days are done. So, kalim hayurot fenuli nishrei shamayim. Now, this is an image that goes throughout Tanakh. When the Tanakh describes a military victory or success, it's always that we have the fleet ability to chase our enemies, and our enemies stumble over each other. And the opposite, of course, is that our swift soldiers are suddenly slowed down and are caught and are trapped and are running away. So kalim hayurod feinu min yishrei shamayim, that our enemies, our predators who are chasing us, were quicker than eagles. And nishrei shamayim may actually mean vultures, and nesher is either a vulture or an eagle, depending on context. Here it's probably more likely to be vultures, but of course, take the image here of Ba'asat Chamal Kanfei Nisharim, leaving Mitzrayim, and here the Nisharim are our enemies attacking us and who are very quick. Alearim Dakunu Bamidbar Argulanu. They chased us on the mountains, they waited for us and trapped us in the desert. It's unclear what this is referring to, because of course they're talking about the destructive Shalayim. Could be talking in a wider net, and it could be referring to the next pasuk. So before we get to the next pasuk, the character who was the most problematic character in the entire narrative of Churban HaBayit is Tzidkiyahu. Because Tzidkiyahu, on the one hand, his name is not an issue because he was named by Nebuchadnezzar, but Tzidkiyahu, on the one hand, is a scion of the Davidic throne. He is Yoshiyahu's son, and rightful heir to the throne. On the other hand, he listens to the Nevi HaSheker and gets himself killed, and gets us destroyed, and gets his sons killed. We'll go to that in a minute. He persecutes Yirmiyahu, but at the end sort of relents. So Tzidkiyahu is a problematic character, and he becomes more problematic in light of this next pasuk. However, what happened to Tzidkiyahu is, on the eve of the destruction, Tzidkiyahu fled from Yerushalayim. And whether he went out through Me'arat Tzidkiyahu or not, I'm not sure, but he fled from Yerushalayim and was caught outside of Yerushalayim by Nebuchadnezzar's soldiers. He was brought all the way to Antioch with his sons, And his sons, Antioch was the staging position for Nebuchadnezzar's conquests in that part of the Levant. And his sons were slaughtered in front of him, and then his eyes were gouged out, and then he was taken as a prisoner of war to Babel, where he died. So you take a look at Bamidbar Arvulanu. They waited for us out in the desert, or they trapped us out in the desert, maybe referring to the trapping or the catching of Tzidkiyahu. The reason I mention that is because of the next pasuk. Ruach apeinu Mashiach Adonai nilkad bishchitotam. Now, who is this? Is this somebody who we anticipate that would be the leader? Probably not. Is this some child of the Davidic line? Very likely not, which is why most Rishonim agree that this is referring to Tzidkiyahu. And there are those who want to paint Tzidkiyahu in a positive light, and this is part of what their support for that is called Ruach HaPenu, our own spirit. Now, we all, most of us are more familiar with this line from Tzur Mishalo than from Eicha, but Ruach HaPenu Mashiach Hashem, he's the anointed one of Hashem because he's from the Davidic line, Nilkad Bishchitotam. He was trapped because of their sinning. Now, whose sinning is this? Is it all the people we talked about? Is it that Tzidkiyahu was simply a puppet again, but in the hands of the Nevi HaSheker? And is that who Yirmiyahu is railing against here? It's a little unclear. But the ambiguity here is very likely deliberate because it allows for multiple fingers to be pointed in multiple directions, which is what we need to do. And the ultimate finger we all need to point, of course, is the one we pointed ourselves, say, what was my role in this? And what should I have been doing differently? What do I have to do to repair it? And what was, but the second half of the pasuk really does seem to point to Tzidkiyahu. Asher amarnu b'tzilo nechiyah b'goyim. We thought we could at least live in his shadow, meaning in his protection among the nations. And instead he was taken and killed, etc. So that's the main piece of the parak. And again, the first 10 psukim describe in painful detail the famine that ensued as a result of the siege. The second half of the parak describes, again in painful detail, the destruction of the city and the entrance of the nations into Yerushalayim and ultimately the killing of Tzidkiyahu, or the capture of Tzidkiyahu. However, the parak ends on a very different note. And we saw a little bit of this at the end of Parak Bet. But here it's in your face. Sisiva Simchi Bat Edom. Now, Bat Edom, of course, opens up great avenues in the Midrash, because Edom midrashically becomes Rome, and therefore this can be midrashically associated with the destruction of the Mikdash in the year 70. But in simple pshat here, as we see in Tilim Kuf Lamed Zayin, the Idumeans participated in the destruction as the willing helpers of the Babylonians. The Babylonians, I have to remember, looked at Yerushalayim from a strategic and military perspective. Not political so much, because politically Yerushalayim just wasn't a heavyweight. But it was a strategic issue because it was in the way to Egypt. And it was a military issue because they had gone over to the other side, so they were in the way. However, the Idumeans evidently harbored a real hatred for Am Yisrael, and therefore were all too willing to come and participate. If you remember the line from Al Narot Bavel, Omrim Aru Aru Ara Yisod Bats, the Bnei Adom were the ones who came in and said to the Babylonians, strip her naked all the way down to the foundation, destroy the city. And it kind of reminds us of the Lithuanians and the Letts and the Ukrainians, let's not forget that, and all of the others who were only too willing to do the Nazis' dirty work for them and even ask for more. And so here we see, Sisiva Simchi Bat Edom. Be very happy about Edom. Yosheret Be'eretz Utz. Eretz Utz is evidently somewhere in Jordan. We know it from the beginning of Yov. Gam Alayich Ta'avor Kos Tishkari V'titari. Your day is going to come. And the coast here, which is alluding to the coast that's mentioned both in Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel, as the Kos Hachama, the Kos Hachema v'Hatar Elah, the cup of punishment and of poison that God's going to make the nations drink, You're going to have your drink. You're going to be drunk from it, and you're going to be killed from it. You'll have your punishment. And now, Tam Avonech Bat Sion Lo Yosif Laglotech. In other words, Bat Sion, you've gone through everything you're going to go through. You will never again be exiled. Of course, that's dependent on fixing things. Pakad Avonech Bat Edom Gila Al Chatotayech. And God is going to remember you, Bat Edom. Notice, no mention for Bavel here. But Bat Edom, God is going to remember your sin and is going to get you. So the end of this parak ends with the best kind of hopeful note you can have under the circumstances, which is, on the one hand, we've gone through everything we're not going through anymore, but more critically, that what we've seen our enemies rejoicing over our destruction, they're going to be punished. God's vengeance will hit them, and we will be able to see that. That's the parak. And again, we could spend the whole hour on the parak. There's a lot here, but I want to take you somewhere else, because as much as Megillat Eicha is among the most beautiful pieces in Tanakh, because that's what happens, is that crisis is, unfortunately, crisis is perhaps the greatest generator of creativity. And just think about great artists that you've known, and how their own pain in their own life was really what generated their art. The same is true in Tanakh, and the same is true in the world of Midrash. As beautiful and as elevating as the passages that we have in Bereshit Rabbah and in Tanchuma, Midrash Eicha Rabbah may be the most beautiful collection of Midrashim that we have. Beautiful, again, in the sense of pain, but beautiful. So what I'd like to show you is just as a taste, but it's a taste that'll take us 29 minutes, of a Midrash on our parak, but I'm going to start with a much better known version of this midrash from the Talmud Bavli. How many of you could do a hand raise on your react button, are familiar with the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa? You've ever heard of it? So I'll assume that a lot of you have put your hands up. There we go. Good. And I'm going to guess that most of you have seen this story. Good, a lot of hands. I'm assuming that most of you have studied the story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa on Tisha B'Av itself, right? And as a result of that, because it's something we're allowed to learn, as a result of that, we don't think about the story very well. And if you were to ask the average person, what is the story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa about? They will answer just sort of instinctively, it's about Sinat Chinam, because that's what we're kind of trained to say. Anything that happened bad in the times of the Mikdash, Sinat Chinam. But if you take a look at the story itself, and by the way, this Midrash, as almost all the Midrashim in Midrash Eicha, are not about the destruction of Yerushalayim in Eicha, which is by the Babylonians in 586 BCE. It's about the destruction of Yerushalayim in the first century by the Romans, and about the destruction of Beitar in the second century by the Romans, and a lot of other things that happened around that. And so we're trained to think that that entire series of events was generated by our own Sinat Chinam. But if you look at the story carefully, we'll see that that's not what it's about. So I'm going to quickly look through the story with you on source one, which is on the right side of the page. And we're just going to do the actual Kamsa Bar Kamsa story itself. And along the way, I'm going to point some things out. I would actually like this to be an open discussion, but unfortunately, just time won't allow for that. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, my dichtiv, Ashrei Adam v'fachei tamid, makshel libo yipol bera'ah. So he quotes a pasuk in Mishlei. He says, what does this pasuk mean? Now, important to note, in Midrashic literature, they're not asking what we would be asking. When you ask, what does a pasuk mean? You mean, what's pshat? Like, what do the words mean? When in the Midrash, when you say my dichtiv, he means this pasuk exists for 1,000 years. However, in our day, we can see an application of this pasuk in the following way. So my dichtiv, this pasuk in Mishlei says, happy is somebody who is always afraid, which is not what it means, as you'll see. It means happy is somebody who's always on guard, who's always wary, and keeping an eye out, perhaps, that they maybe have to shift what they're doing based on new circumstances. And we see that from the second half of the pasuk. This is a fairly consistent style in Mishle to present the ideal versus the, should we say, less than ideal, the better way to do things and the worst way to do things, either in the same pasuk or one pasuk following the other. So happy is somebody who's ready to rethink and shift what their strategy is, and somebody who's stubborn will end up in trouble. So now we assume we're going to hear a story either about somebody who's stubborn and ends up in trouble, or somebody who is wary and changes their strategy and succeeds. That's what we think. So Rabbi Yochanan says, what does this pasuk refer to? And he says it refers to the following three aphorisms. There are three aphorisms out there in Rabbi Yochanan's time. Rabbi Yochanan, remember, died in the year 299. He never saw the Mikdash. He was a very young baby at the time that Rabbi Yochanan was the end of his career. Kamsa Ubar Kamsa Haru Yishalayim. Yishalayim is destroyed because of Kamsa Bar Kamsa. We don't know what that means. Atanigola Atanigolta Haru Turmalka. Turmalka, which was evidently a whole settlement of tremendous cities, was destroyed because of a rooster and a hen. And Ashaka the Dicebach, it should be Dicebach, Haru Beitar. Beitar was destroyed because of the axle of a wheel. Now, what he's commenting on is there is a saying out there in the world that these three sayings, that these cities were destroyed because of these small things. And he says that's an example of this pasuk, that somebody who is stubborn, et cetera, somebody who is wary will do well. So let's see what we have. So we're going to hear the first story. Akamtsa bar kamtsa chari Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is destroyed because of kamtsa bar kamtsa. Now, along the way, I want you to do two things with me. One is, I want you to picture this being staged, because it's important when you're reading a story to picture it happening. Picture this being staged, and I want you to think about your casting call. Sorry, but back home in L.A., they're all on strike, so we got to kind of do something for them. Picture a casting call. How many different roles would you need to cast Kamsa Bar Kamsa? Right? You may be surprised. Besides extras. We know extras are paying $100 a day. They're extras, right? A Kamsa Bar Kamsa Har Yerushalayim. Right, what's that? Tahu Gavra Derachne Kamsa. So there was a guy who liked Kamsa. Ubal Debabe Bar Kamsa. He hated, or Bar Kamsa was his enemy. Right? So there's a guy. So far, how many people do we have? We have three guys. But how many people do we have in the picture? None so far. We haven't described any. Avan Su'udata. So this unnamed guy who likes Bar Kamsa, doesn't like Bar Kamsa, made a feast. So parenthetically, you got to ask, when is this happening? Well, it can't be happening in the few years before the destruction of Yerushalayim, because nobody's making feasts. There's a siege going on. Rich people are wandering in the streets, ready to trade precious jewels for a little bit of flour. Amar le v'shamei. So this fellow says to his houseboy, Zil aiti likamsa. Right? Not because they wouldn't send out this paperless post. The Wi-Fi was very poor in those days. They couldn't do that. They didn't even send written invitations the way that they invited people to things, but they would send their servant out, say, you're invited to this party, you're invited to this party, et cetera. So he told his houseboy, go bring Kamsa. Azal aiti le bar Kamsa. The houseboy went and got bar Kamsa. Now let's stop and ask, why did he do that? So there are three explanations that I've heard proposed. If you have another one, please put it in the chat. One is that he was incompetent. And Kamsa bar Kamsa was basic, right? But that really makes him a doofus, because it means he doesn't know his own master's enemy, who he hates so much, is this Bar Kamsa. You should know that. The other possibility is that he was trying to push a reconciliation, and that he wanted his master, Bar Kamsa, to be kind of forced to encounter each other and somehow make up. And the other possibility is the opposite. He was trying to destroy his master's party by bringing his enemy in. One way or the other, right, that's what this guy says. So we may have a candidate for stubborn guy, right? Maybe the servant. What happened? Ata ashkeche damiyati. So the host came in and saw Bar Kamsa sitting there. Now, what should the host have done at that point? The answer is nothing. He's sitting there. Okay, now, right? Something made a mistake. Fire the houseboy, but let it go. You got to ask a different question. Why did Bar Kamsa come to the meal? So he could think, well, maybe the guy wants to make up with me and make shalom, so very nice, I'll come to the meal. He comes and he finds that that's not the case, because Amarle Mechte Ogavra Baldavame de Ogavrahu, basically in fancy talk, the host says to Bar Kamtsa, you're my enemy. My Baitacha, what are you doing here? Kum fu, get up and leave. Which means at this point, Bar Kamtsa should realize that there was some at least mistake, and he should get up and go. So by the way, as you will see, everybody in this story is stubborn. Everybody in this story is unreasonable. There's only one reasonable and non-stubborn person in this entire story, and you'll be very deflated to learn who he is. All right? So Bar Kamtsa says to the host, look, I'm already here, let me stay. Now, a question, and we cannot resolve this, but something to think about is this conversation taking place out loud in front of other guests, or is it taking place very quietly, he's whispering to him? Because if you think about it, if it's taking place out loud, Bar Kamtsa's already been embarrassed. He's not saving any face. And he's going to look even worse if at the end of this, the dust settles, he's still sitting there. Right? So a little unclear. Right? So he says, let me stay and I'll give you, I'll pay you for what I eat. So you don't have to feel like you're feeding me. Amar lelo, the host says no. Now, this is clearly stubborn. Right? And it gets to the point of stubbornness, it's ridiculous. Amar le himlach me palga de sudatech. I'll pay for half the feast. Amar le lo. The host says no. Himlach me kula sudatech. Amar le lo. So Bar Kamtsa offers to pay for the whole party, and the host says no. Which means the host could have this entire party for all his friends. It won't cost him a penny. Bar Kamtsa, his enemy, is paying for the whole thing, and he still says no. Now, that means he hates Bar Kamtsa with such a burning hatred that he won't take a penny from him, doesn't want him in his house. Or it could mean that, you know, once you're on that path, you're up against the wall, it's very hard to relent. Either way, who's being stubborn here? Both of them. Because if Bar Kamtsa had a half a wit around him, he would excuse himself to go to the bathroom and not come back. But instead, I'm going to stay. So what happened? Nakte biyade v'okme v'afke. It sounds like literally the host picked Bar Kamtsa up and threw him out of the place. Now, Amar, this is very strange. If you guys, many of you are old enough to remember Sabra v'Shatila in 1982, the two refugee camps in Lebanon where Israel was controlling, and phalangists, Christian phalangists, went in and massacred a bunch of the Muslim refugees that were there. And Menachem Begin made the comment at the time that, you know, a bunch of Christians kill a bunch of Muslims and they blame the Jews. Right? But that's kind of what happens here if you take a look at it. And by the way, this is very hard to understand. Bar Kamtsa says to himself, there were a bunch of rabbis there. There was a rabbi's table. And they did not stop this shaming, which now indicates that the conversation is taking place out loud. Or at least they saw me being thrown out. They didn't do anything about it. It must be that they're happy about it. Now, by the way, the story makes very little sense because Bar Kamtsa is angry suddenly at the rabbis for not intervening. He's not angry at the host. And so what does he say? I'm going to go rat on the rabbis. So what does he do? How do you rat on the rabbis? So you figure he would go to the Romans and say, the rabbis are planning a rebellion. The rabbis are meeting secretly and passing laws against what you told them. That's not what he does. Azal Amarle le Caesar, he went to the, now Caesar here does not mean the Caesar. He did not go to Rome, as you'll see. He probably went to Caesarea and went to the Roman prefect who oversaw Judea. And he said, Mardu Bach Yehudoi. Now I want you to picture this. A Jew from Jerusalem goes to Caesarea and goes to the Roman leader and the Roman proconsul and says, the Jews are rebelling against you. So who's he ratting out? He's not ratting out the rabbis. That's what also doesn't flow. So now the Roman guy says, Amarle miyemar. He says, who says? I don't believe you. He's skeptical. Amarle shaderlu kurbana chaziti makarvinle. So Bar Kamtsa says to the Roman proconsul, send a korban and see if they offer it. Now, this to us sounds very strange. Why would the Romans be sending a korban? We have to remember that a major policy of Roman conquest, what we call Pax Romana, Roman peace, was obviously taxation. But the Romans, for the most part, wanted to have a relatively beneficent rule. And they were successful in many cases because they were able to allow the local populace to maintain their traditions and maintain their religion and everything else and just pay taxes and be loyal to the Romans. And once in a while, I would grab a bunch of them up as slaves, et cetera. But that's the price of doing business with the Romans. And the Romans, as good from pagans, believed in all the local gods. And if they were in a country, they said, we have to offer offerings to the local gods, both as a sign of goodwill towards our underlings, shall we say, and also because to propitiate the local gods should be favorable to us. So if they would send korbanot to Yerushalayim to be brought in the Mikdash like they would do in other places. If the Jews refused to offer up their korbanot, it would be a sign that the Jews are rebelling because they're trying to get the Jewish God not to be on their side. This is the way the Romans think. All right, so watch what he says. He says, I'll prove to you the Jews are rebelling because if you send a korban, you'll see that they won't offer it. Okay, but now watch how strange this action is. Again, the only guy in this entire story who seems to be thinking is the Roman. Because he's skeptical. He doesn't believe the claim. And he wants proof. But here's where it gets strange. Bar Kamtso, who he doesn't trust, says to him, the Jews are rebelling. He says, I don't believe you. He says, I'll prove it to you. Send a korban. See if they offer it. So following the story, he should send the korban with one of his officers. Because he doesn't trust Bar Kamtso. Instead, Azal Shadu Biyadei Eglatilta. He sent with Bar Kamtso a big fat calf. Big gazunta calf. So on the way, Bar Kamtso made a mum, a blemish on the animal, in either one of the parts of the lip or the sclera of the eye, somewhere where in Roman practice that's not called a mum, and in our practice it's called a mum. Now this is also very strange because let's say that the Romans would show up on Shabbat with a korban and say, offer it up. We would say, fine, tomorrow. So why not today? Because in our religion, we don't offer up a voluntary korbanot on Saturday. Okay, the Romans would have to respect that. We also don't allow you to do it outside. We don't allow a chazer. So we have our rules. So why the Jews in Yerushalayim can't say, I'm sorry, in our religion, that's a mum, is a little strange. That's why find something that's a mum for us and not for the Romans shouldn't make a difference because the Jews should be able to say, in our religion, that's not a fit animal. Right? So we'll see. Sarabon on the Karuva Mishumishlom Malchut. The next piece of this story, which is a little difficult, is that Bar Kamtso comes with a korban to whom? Normally, when you come, who would you come with? You would come to the Kohanim. Instead, suddenly the rabbis get involved, right? And the rabbis say, you know what? We should offer up this korban, even though it's a balmum, because of shlom malchut. You want to get along with the Romans. You know what? It's not a good idea to make trouble with the Romans, as history has shown us. Now, I'm going to ask you another question. If I were to ask you, can you name some prominent rabbinic leaders from the era around the destruction? I'll tell you two names you would right away come up. Everybody here would say Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai. And you'd probably also say Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, who was the head of the Sanhedrin. You would not in your wildest dreams say Rabbi Zachariah ben Avkulas, who is somebody who shows up only one time in all of halachic literature, a particular halacha about Muktza. But somehow in this story, he shows up and he says, Yomru Ba'alei Mumin Krevin L'Gabei Mizbeach. We can't offer this korban because people will then think you're allowed to offer a balmum on the Mizbeach. Now, notice that this is, I'm sorry to say, a short-sighted thinking because the result of his ruling, if we were to accept it, would be there's not going to ever be korbanot again because the Romans are going to destroy the Beit HaMikdash. And that's what happens. Now, the strange part of the story is Rabbi Zachariah ben Avkulas is a relative nobody. Why is his word carrying the day? Why aren't the other rabbis out voting him? But that's what happens in this story. Savra lemiktalei. So then they thought maybe we should kill Bar Kamsa, the loleza v'leima, so he doesn't report on them. Now, that strategy is an awful strategy, because if the Roman proconsul hears that the guy, the Jew that I sent to Yerushalayim with a korban, got killed by the Jews in the Mikdash, you know, in the area of the Mikdash, then that would really tip him off that the Jews are rebelling. But Rabbi Zecharia pops in and says, he can't do that, because then people will think that if you make a mum, the punishment for making a mum is the death penalty, which it's not. It's makom. And that's the end of the story. And Rabbi Yochanan here says, in Vitanutosh, Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkulas, very strange line. Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkulas is humility. Basically destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. Now, clearly there's an irony here. His humility. Humility is always a good thing. Tid does terrible stuff, but where's his humility here? That's what's difficult. So there's all sorts of interesting comments trying to explain how this is humility. But it's very difficult. The story is difficult on a lot of counts. The first one is, besides the setting of this story, because it's presented as being just about on the eve of the destruction of having a big party, but that we could leave alone, say it was a few years earlier. Besides the behavior of the people involved, but the whole test with the Korban and the way it plays out, and then the role of Zecharia ben Avkulas, is just very strange. Now, remember, this story shows up in Talmud Bavli, so put it maybe at 6th century, the details of the story, 5th century in Bavel. In Echa Rabba on our parak, we have a story that, well, you'll tell me if you think it's the same story. And remember, Midrash Echa Rabba is earlier, it's 4th century, and it's also Eretz Yisrael, closer to home. Tell me what you think. On source 2. There's a story about a guy in Yerushalayim made a feast. Amar leven beito, lech vaveli kamsa, or bar kamsa in the other version, rachami. Azav aitile bar kamsa, or perhaps bar kamsura, son A. By the way, clearly the point of the story is that the names are very close. It's either kamsa, or bar kamsa, bar kamsura. Either way, he says, go bring me the one that's my friend. He ends up bringing him his enemy. By the way, one thing to remember, I asked earlier about casting call. Who would you have to cast for this? So you'd have to cast the host, the servant, who else? So everybody always says Kamsa. Not true. Kamsa does not come on stage here. Kamsa is never in the story. You have to have Bar Kamsa. You have a bunch of extras. And then some Kohanim and rabbis, etc. And the Roman guy. Right? So just keep that in mind. So Azal Aitile Bar Kamsa. Instead, he brought him Bar Kamsa. Al Yashav Ben Arachim. And I'm going to quickly go through this first part because I want to get to the second part. In this story, the host comes in and sees Bar Kamsa sitting there and says, what are you doing here? You leave. He says, let me stay and I'll pay for my meal. No. Then he says, let me stay and I won't eat or drink. A little different than in the Bavli version, but substantially the same. And he says, no. And he says, fine, I'll pay for the whole meal. He says, no. And he says, get up. He doesn't physically throw him out in this version. Now, here's the part I want to pick up at. Remember that the most curious character in the Bavli story is Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkulas. Who is he? Right? And remember that in the story, Bar Kamsa said, the rabbis were sitting there and they were having a good time. I'm going to get them. But instead, he goes and basically rats on all the Jews, not the rabbis. But watch this version of the story. You know who was at the party? Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkulas. He had the ability to stop the host, meaning the host was saw himself as indebted to or loyal to Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkulas enough. Rabbi Zecharia ben Avkulas said to him, don't throw this guy out. Let him sit at the table. He would have listened. And he didn't step in. He didn't stop the shaming. Miyad nafikle. So now Bar Kamsa leaves. Says Amar Benafshe. He said to himself, not the rabbis. Ilan misavian yatrim the shalvaton. These people are eating and having a great time. Ana echul kortzeon. I'm going to rat on them. Right? So he's angry at the guests. We're having a good time, and he got thrown out. Ma'avad halach etzel ha-shilton. He went to the Romans, and he said, Ilan korbanaya dat mishalach liyudoy lemikravinu inan achli lon makarvin achorein ha-chilufayu. He comes to the Romans and says, all those korbanot you send to the Jews, they eat them, and they offer other ones in their place. Nazafbe. So the Roman gets angry at him. I don't believe you. Azal legabe tu, he came again. Amar leikol, Ilan korbanaya dat mishalach liyudoy lemikravinu inan achli lon makarvin achorein ha-chilufayu. The same claim. V'im lo tamin li, if you don't believe me, shlach yichad ifrachu, send an officer with me. Remember, in the first story of our Kamsa goes along. Send an officer with me, the korbanai, and some korbanot, v'at yada miyad she'ni shakran. You'll know right away that I'm not a liar. What happened? Ada'atya ba'orcha damach ifrachu. While they were on the road, the officer went to sleep. Maybe it was overnight. And so they stopped. Kamhu balelia, so Bar Kamsa got up at night, vasan kulan balimumin beseter. Notice, it's not about technical laws. He made all of the animals balimumin, and then now there's not one, there's a bunch of them. Beseter meaning somewhere like, you know, behind the knee, somewhere that it wasn't too obvious. So now the guy is going to get up in the morning, and they're going to walk these korbanot, they look like beautiful animals. He's going to bring him now, the Kohen in Yerushalayim is not going to want to say to the representative of the Roman, your animals are defective. But you see here, behind the knee, there's a cup. Notice, they don't come to the rabbis, they come to the Kohen. He said, oh, you brought three animals? Good, we'll bring three other animals. So the representative, the officer said, how come you're not bringing our offerings? He quoted the Ruzin of Oz and said, come back tomorrow. So this happened for 3 days. He didn't offer them. So the officer sent a message back to the proconsul, which was that what the Jews said is true. The Jews are rebelling. Notice the way it's told here. Immediately he came and destroyed the Beit HaMikdash, meaning, again, that this story is set as being on the eve of the destruction, which is very hard, considering a party. Hada de Briata Amrin, that's what the people say, Ben Kamsa Ben Bar Kamsa Chariv Maktisha. Meaning, there was an aphorism out there. And people, you know, we have all sorts of sayings. A stitch in time saves nine. Well, where does that come from? So here you know where it comes from. Why do people say Ben Kamsa Ben Bar Kamsa Chariv Maktisha? Because of this story. And now Amar Rabbi Yossi. Here it's not Rabbi Yochanan, it goes back to Rabbi Yossi. Now remember, we had this, you see it in yellow at the end of the Babli story. Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkulas' humility destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. But now you understand, it's not his humility in his role in the court, which is very hard to figure out. And why are they listening to him in the court? It's his humility at the meal. He's sitting there, he's an important rabbi, at least important enough to be seen as the rabbi of the host. He could have stepped in and said to his student, as it were, his acolyte, you know what, let the guy stay. Let Bar Kamsa stay. He didn't step in. He allowed Bar Kamsa to be shamed. Why did he do that? Because who am I? Who am I to step in and say something like that? And that fits with something that we see in Midrash Eicha in the first parak. This powerful line. Kach hayug dolei Yisrael ro'im devar v'rav ochim p'nei amen. The leaders would see terrible things happen and turn away and ignore them. Turn the other blind eye. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, the time will come that I'll do the same thing. You'll be hurt and I'll turn away. The story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa is not about Sinat Chinam. The story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa is about a failure of leadership. And that takes us back to our parak, where if you remember, Yirmiyahu points to the Kohanim and the Zekenim as themselves having been the ones who led the people astray. By the way, you see that in Sefer Yirmiyahu. HaKohanim HaMatim Et Ami, the Ro'im who are not doing their proper job shepherding the flock. It's a failure of leadership. And that's something that this story in its Eicha Rabbah version really highlights. And the fellow who gets the finger pointed at as the cause is a rabbi who was at a meal, who saw somebody being embarrassed publicly and could have stepped in to stop it and didn't. And one little thing led to this obviously much bigger thing and the tragedy of the destruction of Yerushalayim. We have a couple seconds, but I'm not sure. I see what you mean by not being humility, and not this not being an issue of humility. It's a different kind of humility. Let me just defend it. It's a different kind of humility. It's kind of the kind of humility that we see, and in when Shmuel talks to Shaul, after the debacle of Amalek, where Shaul's excuse is the people. They're the ones who decided to keep the fat animals to bring korbanot, and basically the problem was the tail was wagging the dog. Is that Shmuel says to Shaul, "Im katon ata beinecha rosh shiftei Yisrael ata." You're small in your eyes, but the real reality is you're the king, you're the leader. Meaning, people are sometimes not willing to step up and acknowledge that they have suasive power and even that kind of charisma where they have the ability to push people into the right direction. Who am I? Now, by the way, this is not humility that we praise. I agree with you. I wouldn't call it apathy or laziness. That's not what the rabbis are pointing at. It could be, I mean, I don't know Zachariah, I never met him. So I don't know what it was like. But Zachariah in the story is presented, at least from the end of it, as somebody who is like, who am I to step in? I'm not, you know, it's not my place. The answer is yes, it is your place. And that's what a leader is supposed to do. And it fits with a theme that we see in Eicha a little bit and in Sefer Yirmiyahu quite a bit, that the real finger pointed is at the leadership. Now, that doesn't get the rest of us off the hook. Because first of all, leaders are only leaders because they have followers. And second of all, every one of us has the potential really to be a leader. But I will have to pick that up next week. I mean, it's Hashem. Next week will be at the regular time of 10 o'clock. We'll do the fifth parak. I'm going to try to do the fifth parak in about 40 to 45 minutes and leave a little time to talk about Nechama, which is what follows Tisha B'Av. But we will see next week. In the meantime, everybody have a great week. And Im Yirtzeh Hashem, you know, we've got another week and a half. By then, Tisha B'Av should be a Yontif, and we'll have a celebratory reading of the fifth parak.